At the end of October 2012, my son Joel and I left Victorville here in California at 5 a.m. and began a three-day drive to Pennsylvania. He had moved there in May to serve as the executive pastor of the Lancaster Evangelical Free Church, and we were taking a car back to the town of Lititz. Now, when I go on a trip with Joel, it's always an adventure. He does not like anything ordinary. He never stops at McDonald's. People are more important than schedule. And he never misses an opportunity for the best barbecue in the state. On the first 1,000-mile leg of the trip, Joel passed the sign, "Last gas for 105 miles, without the slightest hesitation. The next 45 miles later, the yellow warning light flashed on in the car, low fuel. The next 60 miles were white-knuckle driving. For the first 20 minutes, we talked about our options, and then realizing we had none, we could only hope, we lapsed into silence. To conserve fuel, Joel cautiously climbed up Utah's barren desert mountains and then coasted as fast and as far as possible down the hill to get as far as we could go. An hour later, we shouted with joy as we pulled into the first gas station in Green River and filled the tank to all but 3/10 of its capacity. Now, on the second 1,000-mile leg, Joel announced that he wanted to eat at Oklahoma Joe's Barbecue in Kansas City. By the time we got to Kansas City, it was 7:30 p.m., and we were both very hungry. Joel warned me, however, that this is a very popular place, an old gas station whose garage has been converted into a restaurant, and there was usually a line out the door into the parking lot. Naively, I mused that by 7:30 the line might be shorter, but as we pulled in, the parking lot was packed and the line out the door around the building. Now, we'd been driving since 10 in the morning, so standing in line was actually comfortable for a while. But after a half hour, suddenly, it was wasting time. And I said, "Hold my place in line, I'll go fill the car with gas." So going to the parking lot, I got the car, pulled it into the gas station, and filled it. At least I'd learned a lesson about an empty gas tank. By the time I got back into line, it was 8:30, and we were now inside the building. I looked around and couldn't believe my eyes. African-Americans, Asians, Anglos, Hispanics, people from all walks of life waiting in line for Oklahoma Joe's pulled pork. Could it really be worth this wait? There were no empty seats in the dining room, and as fast as people got up from the table, another group sat down. By 8:50 p.m. we ordered, and by 9 o'clock p.m. we sat down at a table and wolfed down our pulled pork and beans. By 9:15 we were back in the car, and I was driving the next leg of the trip into the night. My son Joel sighed. He looked at me and said, "That was great. Now I'm ready to drive till morning." And he did. We stopped at 4 a.m. in Terre Haute, Indiana, only 800 more miles to go. So what's the point? Well, when you go on a journey with Jesus, life is even less certain, more anxiety-producing, and blends a similar mix of white-knuckle driving, waiting for what you're not sure, and feasting with people you don't know for food that is his choice. Now, my reflections on this message begin in two places. First, the text. Judy and I have been meditating on the Gospel of Matthew since January, since Christmas, actually, pondering what it means to follow Jesus. Secondly, on May the 8th, Judy and I attended my 50th class reunion at Wheaton College. And as part of that event, I've read reflections on half-century journeys of 50 of approximately 300 classmates, many of whom are still following Jesus and some who are not. From both of these experiences, I've concluded that following Jesus is a risk-filled, anxiety-producing journey. Our psalm for the morning begins and ends with joyous praise. "How lovely is your dwelling place, Lord Almighty! My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. Better one day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere." Yet in the middle of that psalm, we find we need strength. And our hearts have to be set on pilgrimage. And we're going to pass through a valley called the Valley of Baca, or weeping. As I read through the half-century reflections of my Wheaton classmates, I found most of them had experienced significant testing in their valleys of weeping. And 20 of the 50 had lost their direction and no longer yearned for the courts of the Lord. In anticipation of this baccalaureate, celebrating commencement at Fuller Theological Seminary, I wondered how each of you might look back. Some of you for 10 years, some of you for 20 years, some of you for 30, some for 40, as long as the Lord gives you to live. But if you look back, could you say, our soul yearns, even faints for the courts of the Lord? Today, yes, perhaps that's so. But this day is also a moment of anxiety. You may be wondering where Jesus is taking you and what this will mean for your life. And I wonder if any of you have missed the sign on the spiritual desert about no services for the next 105 miles. How long we have to wait for Jesus to provide new spiritual fuel or for your next assignment? From our meditation in the Gospel of Matthew, Judy and I have concluded that no one can predict where Jesus will take us or what he might say on the way or where that journey will end for us and for him. And even though he will speak clearly to you, as my son Joel clearly warned me about the wait in Oklahoma Joe's, we cannot understand its meaning apart from our inexperienced assumptions and expectations. So let's turn now to the gospel narratives in Matthew 26 of Jesus and his disciples in the final phase of their journey with Jesus to the cross. Drawing from our text, I would like to highlight three areas of tension for them and for us: their conflicted priorities, the deception of hungers, and their denial of their vulnerability. First, their conflicted priorities. Stopping for dinner on the way to Jerusalem, Jesus and his disciples settled in at the home of Simon the leper. Jesus had warned them multiple times on the journey that upon their arrival, he would suffer much and be killed by the teachers and the rulers. In spite of these many warnings, his closest companions were preoccupied with the finances of the ministry. When the woman breaks the alabaster jars, the disciples erupt with indignation. Why this waste? And Jesus rebukes them. When she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for my burial, about which no one remembered. Jesus' defense of the woman illustrates well how Jesus has different priorities, and he rewards the one that sees clearly who he is, overturning our priorities and agendas. In 35 years of consulting with missions and missionaries, I found one of the most frequent questions asked is, why this waste? Often the question is accompanied by accusations, judgment, condemnation, and broken relationships, with the end result that the body of Christ is wounded in the conflict. People making such charges often conclude that it's another person's fault, sometimes the actions of irresponsible local people with flawed cultures. The accusers don't grasp God's agenda for scarce resources. As his disciples, we rarely wonder if such waste might be a gift that Jesus welcomes as ointment for his body, the church. Instead, we maim his body, his bride, to preserve his resources. Jesus rebukes his disciples then, and he rebukes us when we love resources more than we love him or love his people. The second deception we see on the way is the story of Judas. The text does not allow us to see into his mind or into his motives. We only see his question, quote, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him over to you? From the question, we may surmise that Judas was disappointed or hungry for something. When they offered him 30 pieces of silver, he accepted the money and agreed to the plan. From the 21st century, we can look back and shake our heads. How could he do such a thing for such a small amount of money? Reading further in the gospel, Judas has deep remorse and says, I have sinned, for I betrayed innocent blood, Matthew 27:4. The text records that he threw the money into the temple and then went away and hanged himself. We can only ponder what might have been Judas's expectations. What did Judas want at this point of betrayal? But we cannot know, and we don't need to know, because the real question is, what expectations do we have of Jesus? How will we respond when he disappoints us? How long can we drive on low fuel and wait for Jesus to make his will and his purpose clear for us? Will I deny him, betray his mission, undermine his work, even set him up to be crucified again? As I've reflected on the stories of my Wheaton classmates, I cannot know their motives, but they do say what they have left and what they have embraced. The leavings include the institutional church, Christianity, God, fundamentalisms, dogmatism, and faith. The list of embracings include job, travel, recreation, business, community, universalism, family, social justice, Buddhism, and spiritual practices. Somewhere along the way, to follow Jesus became confused with many other things. And for all too many, life without Jesus, and particularly his church, is a life without regret. In my own post-Wheaton crisis in 1968, I read the Gospels, I heard the message in my own understanding, and concluded that the message was a lie. Jesus didn't fulfill his side of the bargain. If you ask anything in my name, I'll give it to you. What was my hunger? I didn't want money. But like the low-fuel journey with Joel in the Utah desert, I could hardly endure the uncertainty of the years of my mother's mental illness. I could hardly endure my father's deep pain, the pressure on me to support them with no relief in sight. I wanted God's action on my behalf, relief from the pain of family mental illness, success in my research, life with fewer struggles and more pleasure. When it was not forthcoming, I responded as if there had been no gas in Green River. Utter disappointment, and then anger and bitterness. I followed the path of Judas, even though I was crucifying him again, and I made a bargain with the rulers of this world. Now, Judas had a deep sense of the reality of his betrayal of Jesus, and so did I. I was unwilling to live with the pain and long waiting for something I could not see or hope for. And yet, thank God, even though I and other of my classmates have denied Jesus, he did not deny or abandon us. Third, their denial of vulnerability. In the third movement of this gospel story, Jesus shares the Passover meal with all of his disciples. And after the final hymn that closes this most powerful movement together, Jesus says to them this, and I read again. "Tonight, all of you will desert me. For the scriptures say, God will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised from the dead, I will go ahead of you to Galilee and meet you there." Peter declared, "Even if everyone else deserts you, I will never desert you." And Jesus replied, "I tell you the truth, Peter, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny three times that you even knew me." "No," Peter insisted, "even if I have to die with you, I will never deny you." And all the other disciples vowed the same. What is our risk of denying Jesus and being scattered? At this time in my life, I have different hungers than I did as a young man. Yet Jesus has not stopped leading me into places I do not want to go. He's still doing it. Last December, Dwight and Lois Baker from Overseas Ministry Study Center in New Haven were visiting in our home. In our fellowship, we talked about our respective adult children and the challenges they faced. Judy and I told them about how the Fuller Semi had published the reflections of Jennifer, our lesbian daughter, and my reflections as a father about our struggles as Christians and how to respond to same-sex attractions in faith. At the end of the conversation, Dwight asked, "Sherwood, would you consider presenting a paper on this topic to the Evangelical Missiological Society?" "Are you kidding?" I said. "Why me?" Less than a month later, Dwight sent me an official invitation to present a paper in a plenary session to the Evangelical Missiological Society in Dallas, Texas, in September of this year, that explores the failure of the church and mission to adequately address sexual issues such as polygamy and homosexuality. For me, this invitation was far more outrageous than Joel's suggestion that we eat pulled pork at Oklahoma Joe's Barbecue. EMS is the meeting of the most conservative leaders in mission, and Dallas, Texas is one of the most conservative cultural cities in the U.S. My immediate reaction was, "Please, no!" Now, I have deep compassion for my daughter, but to risk publishing anything on the church's failure with reference to gay and lesbian issues is beyond my calling. You know, my books are widely read by conservative mainline church leaders. It'll ruin my reputation. I don't want to do this. Lord, take this cup from me. Men and women, I wanted to run away, and I quietly shouted to Jesus, "No, not me. I have other things I want to write. Please don't ask me to do this." As I look back on my journey with Jesus, I've had many such moments, but nothing quite as daunting as this one. "Is it Dwight or Jesus asking me?" I said. I don't want to go there. The temptation in such moments is to run away as the disciples did that night in Gethsemane. And the more we deny that we will not sneak away, the more likely it is that we will happen, and it will happen soon. To me, this is the most important lesson from the text. We are vulnerable. And betrayal emerges out of our deepest fears, emotions, and expectations. None of us are exempt. Now, on four previous occasions in Matthew's gospel, Jesus has spoken clearly about his death, and each time he concludes with a last line that no one heard or questioned. Now again, a fifth time, Jesus includes the last line. What was that last line? Let me read it to you. "But after I've been raised from the dead, I will go ahead of you to Galilee and meet you there." After the suffering and death, there is resurrection. Early in February of this year, after Dwight's invitation, my friend Peter Lynn, a graduate of Fuller, joined us for our morning devotions on Matthew 17, in which this last line occurs twice. As we discussed the story, Peter said, "I always focus on the suffering and miss the last line." And so did the disciples. The last line made no sense to them, and yet without it, there's no meaning to the death of Christ. About the same time in February, Bob Priest, co-chair of EMS, asked if I would present a draft of my paper on gay and lesbian issues to the regional meetings of EMS in Trinity at Chicago. When I grasped the implications of Matthew 17, that Jesus is risen and going ahead of me, how could I refuse? Yet I confess, I struggled with anxiety as I drafted the paper. I dreaded booking the flight and getting on the plane, and I dreaded going to this meeting to give it. I did give that paper, and people received it marvelously well. I'm still uncertain what I'm going to say in September about this topic, but I know I must follow Jesus in what for me has been an unwanted and unwelcome assignment. Men and women, you have prepared at Fuller Theological Seminary for this commencement. And now you're ready to leave Fuller and to follow Jesus on his mission to build and minister to his global church. Like all the graduates who've gone before you, you will find conflicting priorities in that church. You will be tempted to judge and condemn others in the body, and your hungers will not be satisfied. In that moment, when fear and anxiety overpower you, you and your co-workers may be scattered and walk away. And some may never come back. But I challenge you, don't forget the last line. After I have been raised from the dead, I will go ahead of you to Galilee and meet you there. This is the critical issue. Christ is risen. How do we translate this statement of Jesus for the here and now? Just as the 11 with Jesus were scattered on that night, many of you may be scattered, seeking to satisfy your hungers, alleviate your fears outside of the church. But the gospel assures us that the risen Christ will never abandon his body, the church, wounded or broken though it be. So in your moment of crisis with his church, he invites you, in your grief, to come with your precious alabaster jar of ointment and pour it out on his broken body, no matter what it cost. And if you will do this, you will discover he is risen indeed, and he will meet you there.